Welcome to the Behaviorist Book Club. My name is Matt Harrington. I am your host, and we are going to be talking all about ABA research. In this podcast, we break down one ABA research article per episode, taking out the key findings for you so that on your morning commute or on your way into work, you can become a better behavior analyst. Now, let's get to the show. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. We are continuing our essential readings for behavior analysts, and we are on reading number two. Now, I prepped you guys in the last episode. I told you what to expect here. We are talking about towards trauma-informed applications of behavior analysis, Rogerman and colleagues, 2021. Now, a little behind-the-scenes baseball, if you will. There is not a single article that has been more influential on my practice than this one right here. I remember reading Morris and colleagues 2021, where they started talking about assent and consent and how it was different. I remember reading an article, of course, by Hanley and his group about the ISCA. There was a lot of different kind of articles around the same topic that I was exposed to. But for some reason, something about this article clicked. I don't know if it was the way it was written. I don't know if it was because I know D2 outside of journal articles. He's somebody who I consider a friend. I don't know what it is, but this article spoke to me in a way that no other article had and essentially changed my practice overnight. Now, that didn't mean that I started running out and doing ISCAs every second and never doing a functional analysis and I threw extinction out. Rather, this article took the concept of assent and the concept of trauma-informed care from a buzzword to a concept. And I started looking at the actual behavioral differences in the way I would act if I was following this framework of trauma-informed care and putting my interventions through this light versus the way I was acting before, which was putting my evidence-based interventions through a more typical, quote-unquote, traditional behaviorist viewpoint. And I started to see that there were some pretty big differences in the way that I would act if I was going through this framework than the other. I evaluated those differences both ethically and personally. Which one did I want to be doing? As well as how did my clients react to the different frameworks? And I got a lot of great results. And I think that was why this article is so special to me. Is one of my most challenging cases that I ever had as a BCBA became a success after reading this article because I started programming in this light. And I don't think that can ever be taken away. I know there's lots of talk about trauma-informed care as a buzzword. There's lots of talk about, oh, this doesn't matter. This does matter. This is just a marketing phrase. It's all kind of noise to me because I firmly believe that the framework that I have from this article makes me a better behavior analyst. And I think that there's data to prove it. This article is special to me. I hope I can impart at least some of the information onto you, but I want you to read it yourself. And frankly, you probably already have. This is a very widely spread article. So I'm actually not going to go into too detail about like the intro. I'm just really going to focus on the tenets of trauma-informed care and keep this podcast brief because you've probably already read this article. But if you haven't, I hope by now you're convinced that you should. One thing I always like to point out before stepping into this article is while a lot of people point to this article as their genesis for trauma-informed care, like I just did, trauma-informed care has been around for decades. There has been people in the behavior analysis space, specifically I'm thinking of Camilla Kolu and her mentor, who have been talking about trauma-informed care specifically in ABA for years, while there's also been trauma-informed care in mental health practices and other psychology and social work for even longer, right? 50, 60 years, they were talking about trauma-informed care. And so the fact that it's hit the mainstream of ABA is almost comical, right? Because I was talking to my mental health provider friend and they were like, oh yeah, trauma-informed care. Like that's all, we have a whole semester on it. What do you mean it's an article now? Like you guys don't have a whole set of learnings attached to it? I was like, no, I guess we're behind the ball, which is ironic and frankly quite sad. Because a lot of the learners that we work with have experienced some form of trauma as defined by the Adverse Childhood Experiences survey, which the authors point to in this survey. At least 83% have either experienced or viewed traumatic experiences. And that number goes up and down depending on the survey, but it stays high. So this idea of trauma-informed care is pretty relevant because there's a lot of evidence that the people that we work with every day have experienced or observed something in that line just based on the situations that they're around, whether that be special education classrooms or group homes or even clinics and psych wards. So the purpose of this article was to talk a little bit about the barriers and why trauma-informed care likely has been widely adopted in ABA, and then talk about the core commitments of trauma-informed care, not made up by the authors, but pulled from other disciplines, and how it can be applied to the behavior analytic worldview, and also start the argument that omitting trauma-informed care from ABA is going to be detrimental, not only for our clients, but for ABA as a whole. Essentially, trauma-informed care is going to be crucial to the social validity of ABA as we move in past the 21st century. Okay, so what are the essential tenets of trauma-informed care? So first, it is acknowledging trauma and acknowledging the potential impact of trauma. We're reading this in 2025. Around 2023 or so, the phrase trauma-assumed care started jumping around the buzzword behavior analyst world. Trauma-assumed care is essentially the thought that because the probability of seeing somebody with trauma is so high, we're going to act as if trauma is already a part of their life and then change our practices as a result of that. This is different. Trauma-informed care says first we need to acknowledge and identify the trauma, and then we have to see and view the potential impacts on the learner. And this is where behavior analysts really start to pick up when we talk about trauma-informed care, because oftentimes people say, okay, trauma-informed care, that means that we can't do escape extinction. Okay, trauma-informed care, that means that we can't do non-removal of the spoon or something like that. That's not what trauma-informed care is at all. Trauma-informed care, with this tenet that we're starting with, says it is on an individual level because trauma is very individualized. A brief example of this that, once again, is a little too broad is a person who has gone through a traumatic neglect experience in the past. Perhaps they were locked into their room and they didn't have food or water, and they had to be rescued by social workers or some similar situation. So that was a traumatic experience in their past. Then they step into ABA intervention. And this is not a hypothetical. I think this is a similar situation to one of my clients that I worked with. So when I stepped into that situation and I heard the experience of the past, that changes the way that they're going to react to certain interventions, right? That means that any isolation intervention, any planned ignoring attention extinction style intervention is likely going to react as a trauma trigger, and they're going to react very adversely to that contingency, more adverse than I would expect. Their extinction bursts are probably going to be more significant if it's an extinction related to attention and potentially one related to food as well. So the solution was to, instead of using extinction-based procedures or things that remove attention from the environment, I instead used NCR and flooded the environment with attention to get around that same challenging behavior, right? That's trauma-informed care. It is seeing and acknowledging, identifying the effect that it has, and then the therapist changing the intervention because of it. 80 CEUs, $10 a month, 3 to 5 new CEUs being added every single month. Straightforward, simple, that's CEU Streamline. I created the Netflix of CEUs with all of not only my old content, but 3 to 5 new hours of CEUs being added every single month. Right now we're at 85 videos and climbing more and more, with over 400 behavior analysts getting all the CEUs they could dream about for only $10 a month. So if you're interested, go ahead and go to behavioristbookclub.com and click the link that says Streamline Info, or check the link below this episode. I know that you will love it, and I guarantee you that you will get all the CEUs you need at, finally, an affordable price. Next tenet of trauma-informed care is ensuring safety and trust. So trauma-informed care prioritizes a safe physical and emotional environment where the client's needs are met and we're also making progress towards the next goal. The client needs to be able to trust the provider and be able to know that the provider's language and behavior leads to consistent outcomes. Now, this is important, ensuring safety and trust. What is trust, right? How do we ensure trust as a clinician? If you think about it, trust is essentially that somebody observes verbal behavior coming from somebody else that corresponds with a future event. What that means in practice is if you say something, then that thing should happen. And if it doesn't happen, you need to say something else. Now, I'm using say as an easy term, but it really comes down to stimulus, discriminative stimulus pointing to future events, right? This SD corresponds with reinforcement. This stimulus corresponds with the absence of reinforcement, and stimuli correspond with everything in between. So an example of this is like a timer. Now, there are a lot of situations where you would or would not use a timer, but one thing a timer is really good at is pointing out that in the future, something is going to happen, whether that be positive or negative. So having a different timer that counts down to when something challenging is going to occur versus a timer that counts down to when something positive is going to occur is a great way to ensure that safety and trust. Now, we can go into more depth. At its core, it means ensuring that the individual knows what's going to happen next and knows what's happening now. Okay, now a third tenet, promoting choice and shared governance. This comes down to more of the practical applications of setting up your intervention. For example, if there is a period of time where you want the learner to work, is there also an area where they can not work? Is that area completely devoid of reinforcement, or is that area, does that area share the same reinforcement as the work area? A lot of people say, oh, if you can either get stuff for free or work for it, aren't people going to get it for free? Actually not. Lazinski and Hanley, I think 2013 is a great article on this. It goes into all over that choice making. We're going to end up talking about the enhanced choice model, I think, later on in this series. That's a great example of that as well. However, as easy as it would be to point to those two articles and say, just get over it, you need to try it out. And I would encourage you that if they are not choosing the work, if they are only choosing to engage for free, then what about that work makes it something worth moving away from, right? Because if you think about it, if the value is the same, then it should at least be a 50-50, right? So what about that work is aversive? Is it a history in the past of work being aversive so that's carried over? Okay, maybe you need different work. Is it the amount of work? Is it the response effort? Is it the topic? Is it the fact that you're counting blocks instead of counting dinosaurs? Or for my teenager clients, right, are we learning about taking a shower instead of learning about the social contingencies associated with not taking a shower, right? So there's different ways to wrap up the learning to get to the same goal in the end. That's where that creativity comes in here of promoting choice and shared governance. And finally, number four, the one that we are the best at is emphasizing skill building. Trauma-informed care is not the excuse for the therapist in the mental health world or the clinician to just simply coddle and say, oh, I'm so sorry, you've had such a hard life, you never have to learn anything. Instead, trauma-informed care is the emphasis on these are the things in your path and the barriers. We can go around some of them, but some of them we have to go through. And the skills that I teach you are going to make it so it's not scary to go through them. A good example of this is situations where we're teaching learners to tolerate, right? Whether that be tolerating waiting, tolerating absence of a reinforcer, tolerating absence of a caregiver's attention. All of these things that happen in day-to-day life, and they need a coping skill, a strategy, an alternative behavior to do when that situation comes up, that would be a valid skill. This doesn't mean let's go through the ABLEs and pick the next tacting goal just because. This means identifying the barriers that they have in their life and then teaching them skills to go through while also doing it without triggering those barriers. Trauma-informed care. What does it mean and how can you use it in your practice? Like I said, trauma-informed care is acknowledging trauma, ensuring safety and trust, promoting the choice and the shared governance, and then emphasizing skill build. All things that we can do and do really well through our behavior analyst mindset and framework and programming. I just encourage you to spend a little bit of time looking through your current programs and seeing if they match up to what you expect. All right, that's what I got for you. I hope I did this article justice. This is a read yourself article as well as a listen. So I encourage you to check it out. And as always, I will see you in the next one. Thank you so much for listening to our podcast. I hope you learned something, and I hope you continue to learn something as you tune in Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays to the Behaviorist Book Club. If you liked this episode, consider leaving us a review, sharing it with a friend, and most importantly, using it in your clinical practice. There's no other reason why I do this than to make you a better behavior analyst and to make myself a better clinician. See you in the next one.